The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Where is Highway 16 and why is it called the Highway of Tears?
Highway 16 runs from Prince Rupert all the way to Alberta. It's also called the Yellowhead Highway. But the section of Highway 16 from Prince Rupert to Prince George is known as the Highway of Tears because over the past four decades or even more, a great many women and girls have gone missing and or been found murdered along that highway. Those murders and disappearances have largely gone unsolved, and most people believe that they were pretty much uninvestigated and have been for a long time. Although that's changing, I will say there is a commission in place now that's supposedly changing things. But the reason being, and again, this is what most people believe, is that they were largely uninvestigated because most of the victims have been First Nations or Aboriginal girls and women.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors who write from and about the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Adrienne Herron about her novel, A Man Came Out of a Door in the Mountain. So were those murders and disappearances the thing that motivated you to start writing this book?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I heard about the Highway of Tears on an NPR show. A fellow was talking about the worst places to go on a holiday to visit. And he mentioned British Columbia, which astonished me because I'd spent a lot of time up there. And I just think it's one of the most beautiful places on earth. And he mentioned Highway 16, that section in particular, which is exceptionally beautiful. And so he introduced me to the Highway of Tears, what was happening up there. And I fell down that rabbit hole online. And there used to be a website for the Highway of Tears that pictured all the women and girls who had gone missing. It had their names, information about them, even some of the names of their children. And I just grieved. I just learned their names, learned them, and grieved and knew I wanted to write something. But again, I'm not a journalist, and I don't know how to write from true fact or true crime or whatever. And I also didn't want to co-opt a real family's tragedy. I mean, these are real people. This is their story. This is still affecting victims, families, in a huge way. It doesn't go away. So to enter into that and act as if I could talk for them seemed wrong to me. At the same time, I wanted to shine light up there. So it took the fictional route.
Yeah, that's very tricky to try to portray reality when you're an outsider.
Right, and it's being outsider to the place, but it's also being outsider to the experience. And I think anyone who hasn't experienced that kind of tremendous violence in their lives and loss can't fully understand that it just never goes away. And it's a different thing to be involved in that and to be outside feeling bad about it, if that makes sense.
The difference between real experience and compassion,
yeah,
I guess.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
This book has all the great elements of story. It has the strangers arriving in town. There's compelling tension and a satisfying and probable climax near the end of the book. But your writing style, as you said, you're not a journalist, and the way you've included myths have prompted some reviewers to use the phrase magical realism. What do you say to that?
I have a continued battle with this because I can see where that comes from. But I am not a believer in consensual reality, meaning that we all go through our lives and we all agree upon what's real, what's not real, just to get through the day. But at the same time, we're disappearing for 8 hours at night off into a world that none of us can quite explain. And some of us have dreams, some of us don't. But the fact is that we leave our bodies. So that's kind of magical unto itself. The idea of falling in love seems magical to me. The idea of growing old as I wake up every day and see new adventures on my face or whatever, this all seems pretty magical to me. And there it's aspects of life that we tend to include in the real and as a whole agree that this is real and we can accept this. But there's a lot that as individuals, whether it's intuition or things that we see that we make sense of in a different way, or feelings that we have that we don't call real. And I think I do. And I'm not willing to let that go as part of fantasy or magical realism. So that enters into the way that I see the world and how I write.
One of the characters of this book, we're going to talk about the main characters shortly, but one of the characters is basically evil, and you present evil in various forms. There's a chapter called Devils Make the Best Salesmen that I'd like you to read, just as an example of some of the misty presentation, the more lyrical presentation, I guess.
Okay. Threaded throughout the novel are these little interludes that start out in a way kind of as cautionary tales told by one character's uncle to him. And gradually they get a little taken over. But this happens fairly early in the book, and it is called Devils Make the Best Salesman. A man appeared in Uncle Lud's town the year he started secondary, a man who went door to door with a suitcase. He wore a skinny tie and a shiny suit. What he was selling was hidden, locked within the case. "I'd love to show you if you have a minute," he told the woman of the house, children clustered around her. "First, might I have a glass of water?" The road up to the house was dusty, he added, so very dry. While one of the kids went to fetch the water, the rest noticed how the man's shoes sparkled, and they nudged one another. The fellow's hands were smooth and unmarked. They couldn't tear their eyes away as he unbuckled straps, unsnapped locks, and opened his world for them. Sweets! That's what he was selling. Only one flavor. An astonishment. His suitcase crammed full of gold-wrapped candies that unfurled made them all take a step backward. On the corner of the porch, a hound on a chain growled, not so much in response to the visitor, but to the reactions of his family. "Madam," the salesman said, "may I offer you a complimentary sample of my wares?" How could she say no? The sweet was blood-red, varnished, and salty on the surface. The housewife half choked when it hit her tongue. "My fault, mister," she apologized. "I was expecting something else, cinnamon, a spice of some kind." Her tongue dried from the salt, even as the sweet beneath it beckoned. Her hand reached involuntarily for another. The salesman held back, eyeing the children, who'd inched behind their mother, clutching her skirts, hiding their faces from his temptation. "Did you dream this?" I wanted to know. "A story is not a dream," Uncle Lud told me. He went on to describe how a dream is a fractured shadow, a cardboard village. "A story, though," Uncle Lud said. "Now, a story has solid form. You can hang your hat on a story." The devil doesn't care about character development, that hidden code for moral expansion. The buds and branches of careworn emotional depth are anathema to him. He favors regression, backsliding, the wave-on-wave corruption, the dissolution, if you will, of character. Don't ask for character here. Eventually, if not that very day, the candy salesman would find the children at the doorway receptive, and they would be struck by how once on the tongue, the sweet seemed to ripple as if riding an unseen current before dissolving with an audible whoosh, a tiny explosion on the tongue that nothing could replicate, although quite a few children would discover as they grew older how closely the physical effect of that tiny sugar rock resembled a popular homemade drug. The only difference being the candy's effect ended with that marvelous eruption, while the drug's explosion dug craters within them that could never be healed, and they would do anything to get more. "It's only candy," the salesman said. "Surely you've tasted it before."
And drugs and various other forms of evil are woven throughout the story. But let's talk about the main characters. There are five teenagers. Leo is the main narrator, and he has four friends. And they're living in a small town in British Columbia. Tell us about that town and what's going on with these kids.
The town is an entirely fictional town, I should say that right off the bat, but set somewhere off of Highway 16. And it's not an atypical town. It's got a lot of the features that you would find. Logging operations, a lot of the inhabitants are scrambling to make a living. And, I should say I get into this kind of rumble with people about whether they're poverty-stricken or poor. And they are, and I know they are. At the same time, I've never seen them as poor or poverty-stricken writing this, even when I recognize that some of the characters, like Brian and Ursie's mother has died, Brian and Ursie are brother and sister. They're two of Leo's good friends and part of this five-friend group. And their father has left them to go up north to make a living. And in the process, discovered a girlfriend and abandoned them. And so they're scrambling. They're getting by whatever Brian can salvage. And Ursie works at the local motel. Another friend, Tessa, has a family that has been broken up in various ways because of drugs and other things. And she lives with her grandfather and her sister's children, and takes care of the children most of the time in the household. And then there's Jackie, who is probably the strongest of the group in many ways, but also hot-tempered and prone to acts of violence, which she gets in trouble for. And she ends up taking a job at a logging camp pretty much to get her out of the fray of town as a cook's helper. And Leo's the most middle class and stable of the group. His father works up in the tar sands, or as the Canadian government likes to call it, the oil sands. And his mother runs the local animal shelter and is always trying to better him. So he's taking an online physics course during his summer and helping out with his Uncle Lud, who's his father's younger brother, who's dying of cancer in their home. But the town itself is just a normal Northwest logging town in many ways. Not much going on. People longing to leave, people trying to get by.
One of the issues that leads us back to the disappearance of the women is a lack of public transportation. Mm-hmm. And so if there are no men in the household, sometimes these women are left without what we think of as physical protection. Also, they have less money, so they don't have cars. And they end up hitchhiking, which is how they end up disappearing. And Jackie is a case of that, where she works pretty far out of town. What's her situation?
You know, I will say first, it's not just having men or not having men in the household, because a lot of the girls and women who went missing, they had men in their households in one way or another. It is a question of transportation. And for Jackie, Jackie's working out at this camp. To get back into town, she could probably get a ride with somebody on a truck or whatever. The situation for a lot of women along the Highway of Tears over years has been that without a car to get to the next town, say your child's in a hospital or in a medical center and you want to go visit that child, or you need to get groceries, the little village you're in just doesn't have what you need, or you're young and you want to go to a party. To get there, to get a ride is difficult. And you're right, there is no public transportation. Greyhound, I think, just discontinued its service there. It did have some service. But to get from one small town to the other, you're talking about a $40 ticket, perhaps one way or more. It's unfeasible. So hitchhiking for a long time was the mode of transportation. When you're up on Highway 16, there are those big yellow billboards that say, "Women beware. Killer on the loose, do not hitchhike." And then they have some photos of some of the missing women or girls. I have to say, too, that, you know, one of the reasons the RSCMP did not investigate a lot of these disappearances is because they believed the woman had just run off. But how do you believe that of a 12-year-old girl, you know, who's part of a family and going to school every day? That doesn't make sense. So hitchhiking is definitely a part of it. It's part of the situation. And hopefully someone with deep pockets or the government will eventually do something, run a van service that will help.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Adrienne Herron about her novel titled A Man Came Out of a Door in the Mountain. If you tuned in late or you would like to share this program with a friend, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link on our Facebook page. We'll be back in a minute to talk about the outrage that happened after a white girl was murdered, why making someone feel important is so seductive, and the color of evil. Don't go away. We'll be right back. I don't know if this particular investigation was part of your research. It wasn't in the novel, but isn't that part of the society of First Nations people? I know in the United States, if you're on the reservation and you don't have a car, you just hitchhike and somebody will come along and pick you up.
You know, this happens on little islands in Washington State, where I'm from, too, and I'm sure lots of other rural places. You're part of a community, and there is this communal sense of you're traveling my way, or I'm traveling your way, let me give you a lift. And it's just something that people have always done. And this is a break. I mean, it's not a new thing that these murders and disappearances are happening. What's new is the outrage that's built up over time. But this is not a new thing. It's been going on for decades where is it a serial murder? Probably not. It's probably more a culture of someone who's very different from that other culture we're talking about, that communal culture. Someone who travels the highway, a group of people who just don't see these women as people. They mm-hmm. see them as disposable. That's the real thing to address, even more than getting transportation on the highway. That's necessary and important and crucial. But the real issue at hand is how do we view people who are not like us?
To determine that they are just as important as someone else when it comes to Absolutely. Finding out where they went and keeping them safe.
Absolutely. And I talked to one woman at a reading who lived up on Highway 16 or lived in Prince George for many, many years. And she was absolutely unaware of any disappearances or murders until Nicole Hoare went missing. And that was one of the first white victims. And then there was a big push and a bigger investigation that keeps getting attention over time. And it also, what was interesting about that, however, was that it did call attention to the discrepancy in how the cases were investigated. Nicole Hoare's life was not any less valuable or more valuable than the others that had gone missing and been found murdered.
Kevin Seven, love the name, by the way, represents the seduction of evil in the form of gambling. As we've said, there's drugs in this story and all kinds of activities that don't lead to a healthy and prosperous life. Kevin tells Ursi that games, quote, resemble life and death because, after all, what meaning would life hold if it weren't for its flip side, end quote. So explain why a young woman like Ursi would listen to somebody like Kevin Seven.
Well, Kevin Seven seduces her by noticing how special she is. I mean, we're all special, right? And who notices? Our mothers do sometimes, our fathers do, the people who love us do. But when you're someone like Ursi, who is working as a chambermaid at the motel, who's First Nations, who's a big girl, not particularly pretty in any way, sweet, kind, unbelievably good to her brother and her friends, strong, who sees those other parts of her. They see her as just, you know, the face in the hallway, perhaps, or even maybe they don't even see her at all. Kevin Seven sees her. He actually sees her. He sees what she's good at. He sees her weaknesses, and it doesn't matter then with him whether she fails or not. She will always succeed with him because he sees how great she could be and appeals to that part of her. I'm making Kevin Seven sound kind of nice, and he really isn't, but he appeals to that part of her that says, I could be great, maybe greater than you. Which is a whole devil thing to me, is that whole idea of I could be even greater than you.
Well, it kind of explains why a woman would get talked into a relationship that wasn't good for her.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, another thing that happens, and this is not in the novel and it goes unsaid in many ways, but there's a huge slavery trade going on in the world right now that has to do with women. And it happens up in Canada as well, where men come onto the reserve or to reserve schools, and they seduce girls by pretending to be their boyfriends or whatever, and they do get them away in that ways. I mean, this is a worry with some of the Highways of Tears things as well, some of the disappearances, but more so throughout Canada and the world. So is that there is that element of seduction, like you're important. Oh, you're not.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, we don't hear that very often. So,
right.
And it's wonderful when we get it. It feels great.
Yeah.
I was curious about, you're presenting in this novel a very dark evil in various scenarios written, you know, into the story of these characters, and also in the kind of, quote, magical realism, end quote, way. And the evil is dark, but it's presented in the form of Hannah and Kevin as very, very white. I think the phrase you use a couple of times is that their hands look like they've been soaked in milk or something. I mean, it's really, really white. What can you say about that?
I think that talking about evil, we tend to always talk about it as dark and black. And there was just this feeling of resentment towards that representation, where I wanted to flip it, because for so many people, evil is not black, it is white. And so that played into my representation of those characters, is I wanted them to be uber white.
And they are.
Yeah.
Thank you. They are, in a very spooky kind of way. Let's talk about Uncle Lud. He is, as you mentioned, Leo's uncle, and he has a terminal illness, and so he's living in Leo's house with him and his mother, taking care of him. And also, as you mentioned, Leo's mother wants him to excel and get an education for whatever reasons. I didn't see those reasons in the book, but you could only imagine that a parent would want their child to succeed. So she signed him up for this online physics course, which he is just completely uninterested in, but he is interested in sitting for hours and listening to Uncle Lud tell stories, which he then writes down in his notebook. Just talk a minute about Uncle Lud and that relationship and what's going on with Leo.
Yeah, thank you. I think this is another case of being recognized. Leo's mother is half Native, and his father is German. So this younger brother who's relaying all these tales is German. He's not Native. But he's been given these stories over time. He's very different than Leo's father, who's an engineer and rather severe and has very definitive ideas about what a good Canadian should be and do and how one should get on in the world. And his mother, I think at one point in the novel, I talk about their beliefs, and his mother believes very much in the Catholic Church because she was raised that way. Those beliefs are there. At the same time, she rails against a lot of them, and she has her own beliefs, which are more in line with her own traditions. They don't come into this story much. I wrote tons and tons of material on this, so they're integral to me, to the story. Uncle Lud disagrees wildly with his brother and the tar sands, and has fought over the years with him about what it does mean to be a good man. They are both good men, but in very different ways. Uncle Lud has amassed these stories, and he's used them to get through his life. He doesn't live with much either. He inherited a family farm, but he's run it into the ground, just absolutely. And then there's this illness, which may or may not be due also, this doesn't come into the novel, but to fracking. And so there's a little mention of Weebo Ludwig, who's a very controversial figure. He's died now, but he was very controversial in Canada in regards to fracking. So with that complicated interlude, Uncle Lud is important to Leo because he reminds Leo again and again that what he is feeling and doing in his life with his friends is important. It's necessary. What Leo sees in the world is true. Just as what his father and mother see are true, so this other world that Leo sees with his friends is a very real one and needs to be recognized. And Uncle Lud feeds on this with the stories, and Leo's very hungry for it.
So where did some of these myths come from? They sound like tribal myths.
I know when people review the book, they talk about how it's full of all these Native legends and whatever. No, it's not. There's not a single one in there that is a Native legend. I made them all up. The closest thing is I have a chapter called Snow Woman, which I did not know when I wrote about Snow Woman. comes very closely to a legend of Deer Woman. And I guess every tribe has a similar story about a figure. In my novel and in the Deer Woman story, it's a woman who leads young men into suicide, into suicidal actions. And that's the closest thing. Everything else I made up. I had a lot more in there, and some came out. They were just weighing the book down in a different way. But it's every other story was totally fabricated.
Well done. What about the title of the book?
I kept waiting for the publisher to tell me that they wanted the real title soon, and they didn't. I finally asked, and they said, oh, no, we like it. And they actually managed to fit the whole title onto the cover of a book. The title comes from, we were driving on, my husband is Canadian, we were driving on Highway 16 once, and I was very, very frustrated. At this point, knowing the history of the place, for me, and seeing the billboards, it's a place that has a very strong feeling of evil in different spots. And so we were driving along the highway, and I was just wondering again aloud, where does evil come from? Why do people do this? How could someone do this? And finally, this just totally asinine sentence came out. Maybe it just comes out of a door in the mountain. I mean, we're driving through this incredible landscape. That phrase was no help at all to me in writing the book until I was home some weeks later, weeding in my garden, and I remembered a story that my Irish grandmother had told me, told all of us kids, about a man in Donegal who used to come down from the hills after a big payday, after gambling wins or a horse race, and he would set them into gambling further, so much so that a family would be destroyed, maybe more than one. And he would leave shortly before dawn, and as he left, he would lift his hand to the lintel of the door and just lay it there a second. And then he would leave, and my grandmother used to say, no matter how many times they tore that house down or rebuilt something in its place, wherever that lintel had stood would be this mark. And it was his mark. It was the devil's mark. Because he was the devil, of course. And as soon as I remembered that story, I remembered the phrase again, maybe it comes out of a door in the mountain. I went, oh no, it's maybe he comes out of a door in the mountain. So that became the working title and the whole movement for me for the novel, A Man Came Out of a Door in the Mountain.
Adrienne Herron lives in Port Townsend, Washington. You'll find more information about her and her writing, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.